Sally, have you ever heard of a human civilization that didn't have soldiers? No, but Motis aren't human. Neither are ants, but they've got soldiers. Maybe you're right. I'm catching it from Kutyasov. Speaking of which, he wants more frequent reports. You know that every scrap of data gets transmitted raw to Lenin inside an hour? We've even sent over samples of Moti artifacts, and some of the modified stuff the Brownies worked on. Sally laughed. Rod looked pained for a moment, then joined her. I'm sorry, Rod. I know it must have been painful to have to tell the Tsar that you had Brownies on your ship, but it was funny. Yeah, funny. Anyway, we send everything we can to Lenin. And you think I'm paranoid? Kutyasov has everything inspected in space, then sealed into containers filled with cyphogene and parked outside his ship. I think he's afraid of contamination. The intercom buzzed. Oh, damn. Rod turned to the screen. Captain here. Chaplain Hardy to see you, Captain, the Marine sentry announced, with Mr. Renner and the scientists. Rod sighed and gave Sally a helpless look. Send them in and send in my steward. I imagine they'll all want a drink. They did. Eventually, everyone was seated, and his cabin was crowded. Rod greeted the Moat expedition personnel, then took a sheaf of papers from his desk. First question. Do you need Navy ratings with you? I understand they've nothing to do. Well, there's no harm in their being there, Dr. Horvath said, but they do take up room the scientific staff could use. In other words, no, Rod said. Fine. I'll let you decide which of your people to replace them with, Dr. Horvath. Next point, do you need Marines?
Good heavens, no, Sally protested.
She looked quickly to Horvath, who nodded. Captain, the Motis are so far from being hostile, they've built the castle for us. It's magnificent. Why can't you come down and see it? Rod laughed bitterly. Admiral's orders. For that matter, I can't let any officer who knows how to construct a Langston field go down. He nodded to himself. The Admiral and I agree on one point. If you do need help, two Marines won't be any use. And giving the Motis a chance to work that fjunch thing on a pair of warriors doesn't seem like a good idea. That brings up the next point. Dr. Horvath, is Mr. Renner satisfactory to you? Perhaps I should ask him to leave the room while you reply.
Nonsense. Mr. Renner has been very helpful.
Captain, does your restriction apply to my people? Am I forbidden to take, say, a physicist to Moat Prime?
Yes.
But Dr. Buckman is counting on going. The Motis have been studying Murkison's eye and the coal sack for a long time. How long, Mr. Potter?
The midshipman squirmed uncomfortably before answering,
Thousands of years, sir, he said finally. Only...
Only what, mister? Rod prompted. Potter was a bit shy, and he'd have to outgrow that. Speak up.
Yes, sir. There are gaps in their observations, Captain. The Motis hey never mentioned the fact, but Dr. Buckman says it is obvious. I would, he said, they sometimes lose interest in astronomy, but Dr. Buckman can nay understand that.
He wouldn't, Rod laughed. Just how important are those observations, Mr. Potter?
For astrophysics, perhaps very important, Captain. They have been watching yon supergiant for aye their history, as it passed across the coal sack. 'Twill go supernova, and then become a black hole, and the Motis say they know when.
Midshipman Whitbread laughed. Everyone turned to stare at him. Whitbread could hardly control his features.
Sorry, sir, but I was there when Gavin told Buckman about that. The eye will explode in A.D. 2,774,020 on April 27th between 4 and 4:30 in the morning, they say. I thought Dr. Buckman was going to strangle himself. Then he started doing his own checking. It took him 30 hours.
Sally grinned.
And he almost killed the fjunch doing it, she added. Had Dr. Horvath's Moti translating for him when his own came apart.
Yes, but he found out they were right, Whitbread told them. The midshipman cleared his throat and mimicked Buckman's dry voice.
Damned close, Mr. Potter.
I've got the mathematics and observations to prove it.
You're developing a talent for acting, Mr. Whitbread, First Lieutenant Cargill said. Pity your work in astrogation doesn't show a similar improvement.
Captain, it seems to me that Dr. Buckman can get everything he needs here. There's no reason for him to go to the Modi planet.
Agreed. Dr. Horvath, the answer is no. Besides, do you really want to spend a week cooped up with Buckman?
You needn't answer that, he added quickly.
Whom will you take?
Horvath frowned for a moment.
Devon Dahlia, I suppose.
Yes, please, Sally said quickly. We need a geologist. I've tried digging for rock samples, and I didn't learn a thing about the makeup of Moat Prime. There's nothing but ruins made up of older ruins.
You mean they don't have rocks? Cargill asked.
They have rocks, Commander, she answered. Granite and lava and basalts, but they aren't where whatever form this planet put them. They've all been used for walls or tiles or roofs. I did find cores in a museum, but I can't make much sense out of them.
Now, wait a minute, said Rod. You mean you go out and dig at random, and wherever you dig you find what's left of a city? Even out in the farmlands?
Well, there wasn't time for many digs, but where I did dig, there was always something else underneath. I never knew when to stop. Captain, there was a city like AD 2000 New York under a cluster of adobe huts without plumbing. I think they had a civilization that collapsed perhaps 2,000 years ago.
That would explain the observation lapses, Rod said. But they seemed brighter than that. Why would they let a civilization collapse?
He looked to Horvath, who shrugged.
I have an idea, Sally said. The contaminants in the air. Wasn't there a problem with pollution from internal combustion engines on Earth sometime during the Co-Dominium? Suppose the Motis had a civilization based on fossil fuels and ran out. Mightn't they have dropped back into an Iron Age before they developed fusion power and plasma physics again? They seem to be awfully short on radioactive ores.
Rod shrugged.
A geologist could help a lot, then. And he has far more need to be on the spot than Dr. Buckman does. I take it that's settled, Dr. Horvath?
The science minister nodded sourly.
But I still don't like this Navy interference with our work. You tell him, Dr. Hardy. This must stop.
The chaplain linguist looked surprised. He had sat at the back of the room, saying nothing but listening attentively.
Well, I have to agree that a geologist will be more useful on the surface than an astrophysicist, Anthony. And, Captain, I find myself in a unique position. As a scientist, I cannot approve of all these restrictions placed on our contact with the Motis. As representative of the Church, I have an impossible task. And as a Navy officer, I think I have to agree with the Admiral.
Everyone turned toward the portly chaplain in surprise.
I am astonished, Dr. Hardy, Horvath said. Have you seen the smallest evidence of warlike activities on Moat Prime?
Hardy folded his hands carefully and spoke across the tops of his fingertips.
No, and that, Anthony, is what concerns me. We know the Motis do have wars. The Mediator class was evolved, possibly consciously evolved, to stop them. I do not think they always succeed. So why are the Motis hiding their armaments from us? For the same reason we conceal ours is the obvious answer, but consider we do not conceal the fact that we have weapons, or even what their general nature is. Why do they?
Probably ashamed of them, Sally answered. She winced at the look on Rod's face.
I didn't really mean it that way, but they have been civilized longer than we have, and they might be embarrassed by their violent past.
Possibly, Hardy admitted.
He sniffed his brandy speculatively.
And possibly not, Sally. I have the impression the Motis are hiding something important, and hiding it right under our noses, so to speak.
There was a long silence. Horvath sniffed loudly.
Finally, the science minister said, And how could they do that, Dr. Hardy? Their government consists of informal negotiations by representatives of the Givers of Orders class. Every city seems to be nearly autonomous. Mote Prime hardly has a planetary government, and you think they're able to conspire against us? It is not very reasonable.
Hardy shrugged again. From what we have seen, Dr. Horvath, you are certainly correct, and yet I cannot rid myself of the impression that they are hiding something.
They showed us everything, Horvath insisted, even Givers of Orders households, where they don't normally have visitors.
Sally was just getting to that before you came in, Rod said quickly. I'm fascinated. How does the Moti officer class live? Like the Imperial aristocracy?
That's a better guess than you might think, Horvath boomed. Two dry martinis had mellowed him considerably. There were many similarities, although the Motis have an entirely different conception of luxuries from ours. Some things in common, though. Land, servants, that sort of thing.
Horvath took another drink and warmed to his subject.
Actually, we visited two households. One lived in a skyscraper near the castle. Seemed to control the entire building. Shops, light industry, hundreds of browns and reds and workers, and, oh, dozens of other castes. The other one, though, the agriculturist, was very like a country baron. The workforce lived in long rows of houses, and in between the row houses were fields. The baron lived in the center of all that.
Rod thought of his own family home. Crucis Court used to be surrounded by villages and fields. But of course all the villages were fortified after the secession wars. So was the court, for that matter.
Odd you should say that, Horvath mused. There was a sort of square, fortified shape to the barony, too. Big atrium in the middle. For that matter, all the residential skyscrapers have no windows on the lower floors, and big roof gardens. Quite self-sufficient. Looked very military. We don't have to report that impression to the Admiral, do we? He'd be sure we'd discovered militaristic tendencies.
Are you so sure he'd be wrong? Jack Cargill asked. From what I've heard, every one of those Givers of Orders has a self-sufficient fortress. Roof gardens. Brownies to fix all the machinery. Too bad we can't tame some of them to help Sinclair.
Cargill noted his captain's black look, and hurriedly added, Anyway, the agriculturist might have a better chance in a fight, but both those places sound like forts. So do all the other residential palaces I've heard about. Dr. Horvath had been struggling to control himself, while Sally Fowler attempted without success to hide her amusement. Finally she laughed.
Commander Cargill, the Motis have had space travel and fusion power for centuries. If their buildings still have a fortress look, it must be traditional. There's no possible purpose. You're the military expert. Just how would building your house that way help you against modern weapons?
Cargill was silenced, but his expression showed he wasn't convinced. You say they try to make their houses self-sufficient? Rod asked. Even in the city? But that is silly. They'd still have to bring in water.
It rained a lot, said Renner. 3 days out of six.
Rod looked at the sailing master. Was he serious?
Did you know there are left-handed Motis? Renner continued. Everything reversed. 2 6-fingered left hands, 1 massive right arm, and the swelling of the skull is on the right.
It took me half an hour to notice, Whitbread laughed. The new Moti behaved just like Jackson's old one. He must have been briefed.
Left-handed, said Rod.
Why not?
At least they'd changed the subject. The stewards brought in lunch and everyone fell to. When they finished, it was time to leave for the moat.
A word with you, Mr. Renner, Rod said as the sailing master was about to go. He waited until everyone but Cargill was gone. I need an officer down there, and you're the one senior man that I can spare who meets the Admiral's restrictions. But although you've no weapons but your sidearms, and no marines, that's a military expedition, and if it comes to it, you're in charge.
Yes, sir, Renner said.
He sounded puzzled. If you had to shoot a man or a Moti, could you do it?
Yes, sir.
You answered that very quickly, Mr. Renner.
I thought it over very slowly. Some time passed when I knew I was joining the Navy. If I had decided I was incapable of shooting anyone, I'd have had to make damned sure the captain knew it. Blaine nodded. Next question. Can you recognize the need for military action in time to do something, even if what you do is hopeless?
I think so. Captain, can I bring up something else? I do want to go back and...
Speak your piece, Mr. Renner.
Captain, your fjunsch went mad.
I'm aware of that, Captain Blaine said coldly.
I think the Tsar's hypothetical fjunsch would go mad much faster. What you want is the one officer aboard this ship who is least inclined to the military way of thinking.
Get aboard, Mr. Renner, and good luck.
Aye, aye, sir.
Renner made no attempt to hide his lopsided grin as he left the cabin.
He'll do, Captain, Cargill said.
I hope so, Number One.
Jack, do you think it was our military manner that drove my Moti crazy?
No, sir.
Cargill seemed positive.
Then what did?
Captain, I don't know.
I don't know a lot of things about those bug-eyed monsters. There's only one thing I am sure of, and that is they're learning more about us than we are about them.
Oh, come on, Number One. They take our people anywhere they ask to go. Sally says they're bending over backwards. Well, for them, that isn't so hard to do. But anyway, she says they're very cooperative, not hiding a thing. You've always been scared of the Motis, haven't you? Any idea why?
No, Captain.
Cargill looked closely at Blaine and decided that his boss wasn't accusing him of funk.
I just don't like the feel of this.
He glanced at his pocket computer to note the time.
I've got to hurry, Skipper. I'm supposed to help Mr. Berry with that coffee business.
Berry. Jack, I've been meaning to speak to you about him. His Moti lives on the embassy ship now. Berry's moved to the cutter. What do they talk about?
Sir?
They're supposed to be negotiating trade deals.
Sure, but Berry knows a lot about the Empire. Economy, industry, general size of the fleet, how many outies we've got to deal with. You name it, and he'd probably know it.
Cargill grinned. He hasn't let his right hand know how many fingers there are on the left, Captain. What's he going to give the Moti for free? Besides, I've sort of made sure he won't say anything you wouldn't approve of.
Now, how did you do that?
I told him we'd bugged every inch of the cutter, sir.
Cargill's grin broadened.
Sure, he knows we can't listen to every one of those bugs every time, but...
Rod returned the grin.
I expect that'll work.
Okay, you'd better move along to the coffee klatch. You sure you don't mind helping with this?
Hell, Skipper, it was my idea.
If Barry can show the cooks how to make better coffee during combat alerts, I might even change my opinion of him. Just why is he being kept a prisoner on this ship, anyway?
Prisoner?
Commander Cargill.
Skipper, everybody in the crew knows there's something funny about that man's being aboard. The grapevine has it he's implicated in the new Chicago revolt, and you're hanging on to him for the Admiralty.
That's about right, isn't it?
Somebody's doing a lot of talking, Jack. Anyway, I can't say anything about it.
Sure.
You've got your orders, Skipper.
But I notice you aren't trying to deny it.
Well, it figures. Your old man is richer than Barry. I wonder how many Navy people might be for sale.
It scares me, having a guy who could buy a whole planet as our prisoner.
Cargill moved quickly through the companionway to the main crew kitchen. The night before, the dinner party conversation had somehow turned to coffee, and Barry had lost his usual bored detachment when he spoke at length on the subject. He had told them of the historic Mocha Java blend, still grown in places like Macassar, and the happy combination of pure Java and the Grua, distilled on Prince Samuel's world. He knew the history of Jamaica Blue Mountain, although he'd said, not its taste. As dessert was ending, he suggested a coffee tasting, in the manner of a wine tasting party. It had been an excellent ending to an excellent dinner, with Barry and Nabil moving like conjurers among filter cones and boiling water and hand-lettered labels. All the guests were amused,
and it made Barry a different man somehow. It had been hard to think of him as a connoisseur of any kind. "But the basic secret is to keep the equipment truly clean," he had said. "The bitter oils of yesterday's coffee will accumulate in the works, especially in percolators." It had ended with Barry's offer to inspect MacArthur's coffee-making facilities the next day. Cargill, who thought coffee as vital to a fighting ship as torpedoes, accepted happily. Now he watched as the bearded trader examined the large percolator and gingerly drew a cup. "The machine is certainly well kept," he said. "Very well kept. Absolutely clean. And the brew is not reheated too often. For standard coffee, this is excellent, Commander." Puzzled, Jack Cargill drew a cup and tasted it. "Why, that's better than the stuff the wardroom gets." There were sidelong glances among the cooks. Cargill noticed them. He noticed something else, too. He ran a finger along the side of the percolator and brought it away with a brown oil stain. Barry repeated the gesture, sniffed at his finger, and touched the tip of his tongue to it. Cargill tasted the oil in his hand. It was like all the bad coffee he had ever swallowed for fear of falling asleep on duty. He looked again at the percolator and stared at the spigot handle. "Miniatures," Cargill growled. "Take that damned thing apart." They emptied the machine and disassembled it, as far as it would go. Parts made to unscrew were now a fused unit. But the secret of the magic percolator seemed to be selective permeability in the metal shell. It would pass the older oils. "My company would like to purchase that secret from the Navy," said Barry. "We'd like to have it to sell." "Okay, Ziffrin, how long has this been going on?"
"Sir?"
The petty officer cook seemed to be thinking. "I don't know, sir. Maybe 2 months?"
"Was it this way before we sterilized the ship and killed off the miniatures?"
Cargill demanded.
Yes, sir,"
the cook said. But he said it hesitantly, and Cargill left the mess with a frown. 29. Watchmakers. Cargill made his way to Rod's cabin. "I think we've got brownies again, Skipper," he told Y. "Have you talked to Sinclair?" Rod asked. "Jesus, Number One, the Admiral will go out of his mind. Are you sure?"
"No, sir, but I intend to find out.
Skipper, I'm positive we looked everywhere when we cleaned out the ship. Where could they have hidden?"
"Worry about that when you know we've got them.
Okay, take the Chief Engineer and go over this ship again, Jack. And make damned sure this time."
"Aye, aye, Skipper."
Blaine turned to the intercom screens and punched inputs. Everything known about miniatures flashed across the screens. There was not very much. The expedition to Moat Prime had seen thousands of the miniatures throughout Castle City. Renner's Moti called them watchmakers, and they functioned as assistants to the Brown engineers. The big Motis insisted the watchmakers were not intelligent, but inherited an ability to tinker with tools and equipment, as well as the typical Moti instinct of obedience to the higher castes. They required training, but the adult watchmakers took care of most of that. Like other subservient castes, they were a form of wealth, and the ability to support a large household of watchmakers, engineers, and other lower forms was one measure of the importance of a master. This last was a conclusion of Chaplain Hardy, and not definitely confirmed. An hour passed before Cargill called.
"We've got 'em, Skipper,"
the first lieutenant said grimly. "The B-deck air adsorber converter. Remember that half-melted thing Sandy repaired?"
"Yes."
"Well, it doesn't stick out into the corridor anymore. Sandy says it can't possibly work, and he's digging into it now. But it's enough for me. We've got 'em." "Alert the Marines, Number One. I'm going to the bridge."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Cargill turned back to the airmaker. Sinclair had the cover off and was muttering to himself as he examined the exposed machinery. The guts had changed. The casing had been reshaped. The second filter Sinclair had installed was gone, and the remaining filter had been altered beyond recognition. Goop seeped from one side into a plastic bag that bulged with gas. The goop was highly volatile.
"Aye," Sinclair muttered. "And the other typical signs, Commander Cargill. Screw fastenings fused together, missing parts and the rest."
"So it's brownies."
"Aye," Sinclair nodded.
"We thought we'd killed the lot months ago, and my records show this was inspected last week.
'Twas normal then."
"But where did they hide?"
Cargill demanded. The chief engineer was silent. "What now, Sandy?"
Sinclair shrugged.
"I'd say we look to hangar deck, sir. 'Tis the place least used aboard this ship."
"Right."
Cargill punched the intercom again.
"Skipper, we're going to check hangar deck, but I'm afraid there's no question about it. There are live brownies aboard this ship."
"Do that, Jack. I've got to report to Lennon."
Rod took a deep breath and gripped the arms of his command chair as if he were about to enter combat.
"Get me the Admiral."
Kutyusov's burly features swam on the screen. Rod reported in a rush of words.
"I don't know how many, sir," he finished. "My officers are searching for additional signs of the miniatures."
Kutyusov nodded. There was a long silence while the Admiral stared at a point over Blaine's left shoulder.
"Captain, have you followed my orders concerning communications?" he asked finally.
"Yes, sir. Constant monitoring of all emissions to and from MacArthur. There's been nothing."
"Nothing so far as we know," the Admiral corrected.
"We must assume nothing. But it is possible that these creatures have communicated with other motis. If they have, we no longer have any secrets aboard MacArthur. If they have not, Captain, you will order the expedition to return to MacArthur immediately, and you will prepare to depart for New Caledonia the instant they are aboard. Is this understood?"
"Aye, aye, sir," Blaine snapped.
"You do not agree?"
Rod pondered for a moment. He hadn't thought beyond the screams he'd get from Horvath and the others when they were told. And surprisingly, he did agree.
"Yes, sir. I can't think of a better course of action.
But suppose I can exterminate the vermin, sir?"
"Can you know you have done that, Captain?"
Kutyusov demanded.
"Nor can I know it. Once away from this system, we can disassemble MacArthur piece by piece, with no fear that they will communicate with others. So long as we are here, that is constant threat, and it is risk I am not prepared to take."
"What do I tell the motis, sir?" Rod asked.
"You will say there is sudden illness aboard your vessel, Captain, and that we are forced to return to Empire. You may tell them your commander has ordered it, and you have no other explanation. If later explanations are necessary, Foreign Office will have time to prepare them. For now, this will do."
"Yes, sir."
The Admiral's image faded. Rod turned to the watch officer.
"Mr. Crawford, this vessel will be leaving for home in a few hours. Alert the department heads, and then get me Renner on Moat Prime."
A muted alarm sounded in the castle. Kevin Renner looked up sleepily to see his moti at the intercom screen that formed inside one of the decorative paintings on the wall.
"The captain wants you," the moti said.
Renner glanced at his pocket computer. It was almost noon on MacArthur, but the middle of the night in Castle City. He climbed sleepily to his feet and went to the screen. The expression on Blaine's face brought him to full alert.
"Yes, Skipper?"
"There's a small emergency aboard, Mr. Renner. You'll have to ask the motis to send up all our personnel, yourself included."
"Dr. Horvath won't want to come, sir," Renner said.
His mind raced furiously. There was something very wrong here, and if he could read it, so could the motis. Blaine's image nodded.
"He'll have to nonetheless, mister. See to it."
"Yes, sir.
What about our motis?"
"Oh, they can come up to the cutter with you," Blaine said. "It's not all that serious. Just an OC matter."
It took a second for that to sink in. By the time it did, Renner was in control of himself. Or hoped he was.
"Aye, aye, Captain. We're on the way."
He went back to his bunk and sat carefully on the edge. As he put on his boots, he tried to think. The motis couldn't possibly know the Navy's code designations, but OC meant top military priority, and Blaine had been far too casual when he had said that.
Okay, he thought. The Motis know I'm acting. They have to. There's a military emergency out there somewhere, and I'm to get the hostages off this planet without letting the Motis know it. Which means the Motis don't know there's a military emergency, and that doesn't make sense.
Fionch,
his Moti reminded him.
What is the matter?
I don't know, Renner replied, quite honestly.
And you do not want to know, the Moti said. Are you in trouble?
Don't know that either, Renner said.
You heard the captain.
Now, how do I go about getting everybody moving in the middle of the night?
You may leave that to me, said Renner's Moti.